Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. And if you cherish companion animals, I think you're going to relate to this. One day, our dog Dara, and I've posted plenty of Twitter pics of her, seemed young, and she seemed even puppyish. And then abruptly, a couple of months ago, we noticed the signs of aging. And because we've loved five dogs into old age and beyond, we greeted those signs with no small amount of dread. Eileen Miles knows what that is, to become suddenly aware of time slipping away for a companion animal and thinking, how many more trips to the beach? How long will my dog be able to manage the stairs? How do I stop time? As Eileen joins us, I'd like you to think about this. Tell me about what being a companion to an aging animal taught you about yourself and what you value. I see a lot of you weighing in on Twitter. You want to send me a photo around that? That's great, too. It's at @CarrieNPR. But call in as well and talk to us about this experience of being with an animal into older age, yours and theirs. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and again on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Eileen Miles' new memoir is titled Afterglow, a dog memoir. Eileen, welcome. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
See, that's the thing, isn't it, that we go out into the world and we have all these interactions with these people and we form these relationships with a lot of different people, but our relationships with our animals are so singular and intense. I get the sense that you really discovered that and thought about it a lot in the memoir.
Well, I think the interesting thing about an animal is that it's actually a nonverbal relationship. I mean, we have language that is about our will in relationship to the dog and come and go and sit and so on. But most of the time, the dog is simply absorbing who you are as a mammal as you're absorbing them. I mean, there's kind of an agreement to be animals in the world together.
What a good point, because I got a tweet from somebody who said the thing that I learned, I think this is from Manny, is that I'm also an aging animal and that's okay. I mean, right? Your dog taught you about what it means to age for yourself, too.
And yes, and to die. And I mean, I lost a parent when I was a child, and my parent was quite young, and I really wasn't equipped to understand that loss or that death. And so with the dog, I mean, the thing that's so interesting is a dog, you know, they have usually a 15-year or so life. So conceivably, you could have five dog lives in your life. And so a dog life is like you get to meet a puppy and you get to go through the whole thing and then you lose them. So you really get a sense of mortality in a dog sized chunk.
OK.
And so it's a philosophical exchange.
You're right. Maybe you've thought deeply enough about this that you don't do what I do, which is, as you've just said, I know this is a finite amount of time with my animal. And I can't help but think about that time slipping away. I kind of veer away from that. You let yourself feel the suffering, I think, even long after Rosie, your dog, was gone. How'd you do it?
Well, I did it. I didn't do it in the beginning. I mean, when I first got her and I read some dog book and it said, congratulations, you have a friend you'll have for 15 or 20 years. And I was like, what? And the length of the time seemed too hard to understand, and I didn't believe in her dying or her death until we got pretty close. And once I was there, I mean, also, you know, I'm part of the generation I lost lots of friends to AIDS, so I was near a lot of death at a certain point in my life, and yet I didn't. It wasn't a partner that I lost. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't right there for it. So there was a way in which I was really up for it, like I wanted to see this and be with it, and I knew Rosie intimately.
And she knew you intimately.
Absolutely.
What do you mean when you say, I didn't really believe in her death until we were very close to the end?
Well, I did, you know, I'm 67 today, and I didn't really believe in my own death in my 40s or my 50s. And I guess now, just because it's a bit of a crapshoot, I can see that percentage-wise, people do tend to die, and they tend to die in this decade or the next one or the one after that. So, you know, like, I think it's innate as a human to be in denial about mortality, one's own. So it's we pass that to the dog, too.
Call here from Maggie in Minneapolis. Hi, Maggie. Sounds like you've been through this.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling because I had a cat that I loved, and a lot of people talk about their dogs, but I had a cat that I had really been intimate with for 16 years who died of kidney disease, but I made the choice of when she would die. I had never had an animal through its whole life. I love that cat, and I still love her. I think about her quite often. But what really, getting to your point, what did I learn? I really thought a lot about when would I no longer take extraordinary measures to keep her alive. Mm-hmm. I read a lot about people's experience who waited too long and who found that it was not a peaceful death for their companion. And I made what I think was a compassionate decision to put her to sleep at a time when I knew that she was about to die, but she had not yet come to that extraordinary pain. And she died peacefully in my chest. Still painful for me to think about.
I'm sure.
But what I do think, what really came to mind for me was how family members have to make decisions about when, if they need to take someone off of a machine, or the very deep pain that comes with having to decide about the life of someone you love so dearly, and the importance of having an end-of-life instruction for family members. So, you know, a lot of things about the pain that those decisions could bring. I had not gone through that with my own family members who have died, but I have now with this companion who I have no desire to replace. She was very special to me. And I do believe that she died peacefully because of my decisions. I try to hold on to that, but there's always questioning. Could it have been a couple more years? Could it have been one more day?
Maggie, I'm appreciative for the call. Eileen? What do you hear in that?
Well, I guess I think every decision has echoes of what if it went this way? What if it went that way? And I think one of the things I felt with Rosie is I had the option, and I don't mean this as a privilege because a poor person could have the same privilege. I had the time. I mean, it's sometimes with an animal's death, it's like, do you have the time to dedicate to this dying? And if you do, it's kind of a strange, rich, profound luxury. To be, you know, like my mother died in April, and it was, you know, were we able to come and be there and spend those, you know, as it turned out, 5 days with her, you know, and sometimes it's the luck of the draw that you do get that time and you are there. But it's also a choice to decide, because people, you know, in the same way that like when women give birth, you know, I've heard talk about, you know, like doctors who they were golfing that weekend, so they decided to give her a cesarean because it saved time.
Right.
And I think people put their dogs down because, you know, let's get to it. I'm busy, you know. And I think one thing that I felt was profound was to decide to be there and to have that time and to be with it, you know. And it's you know, it just speaks Bibles of profundity to make that road be open for yourself.
This is exactly right. I mean, there is, and I think what Maggie was telling us about echoes some of this. There is the practicality, but also the how where in my life does this moment with my companion animal fit, but also that am I making the right choice at the right time? So did you have moments of questioning that? It sounds to me from reading the memoir like you did, although you sound pretty certain now. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it's just I'm of both minds. And I think because I felt guilty. It was just like she was still as hell. She looked like she had nothing left, but she was still breathing and she still ate at the, you know, at the doctor's office, at the vet's office. My friend went out and got her some Mexican food and fed her carne asada, and she was still eating moments before she died. So it's like, you know, there's those questions like, do they still want to eat? Yes. So is that the reason to keep this dog alive? You know, I mean, the good news is that we don't entirely have that option with human beings. I mean, which is not entirely a good thing either, but it was so hard to know with a dog and many, 9 out of 10 ways I do know, but there's still that 10th way in which I felt guilty and bad. And that's in my book, too. My apologies to Rosie for taking her out that moment.
It is. You know, I was thinking this is also the thing that we carry this decision and the burden of that ourselves, because, of course, our animals don't have the consciousness to know that it's coming to that. And you have this wonderful paragraph where it seems like that's on your mind. You're seeing Rosie in the sun. You can see the wrinkles on her chest. And you write this, she doesn't care. She wears her body like her favorite clothes. Age is a slight inconvenience on her way to sudden meals. I mean, we should all live like that for a while, Eileen. I love
Dogs are such presentists.
Right.
I mean, I think that's why we love them so much, because they're not like, wait a second, I have this thought. Wait, I've got to take this call. Hold on. You know, they're just absolutely there.
Laura says on Twitter, I found that I was more patient and sentimental than I ever knew, but also selfish because despite her health decline, I didn't want to let her go. And David says, yeah, we're hearing about patience here. David says that I had more patience than I realized. I lost my 18-year-old gal a few years ago. She joined the family when I was 12 and moved with me to Louisville. Eileen Miles is with us. We're talking about the memoir. It's called Afterglow, A Dog Memoir. And I'm asking you, as you hear our conversation, about what it means to be a companion to an aging animal and what it has taught you about yourself. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR, and Charlie in Stillwater. Hey, Charlie, what do you want to talk about with Eileen? Hi.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add that I've had cats and dogs my whole life, and we have a cemetery in our backyard. it's very emotional when they pass indeed. But I try to stand back, look at the bigger picture about what's most important in life, and I worry sometimes it's subordinate the needs of people and of orphans and of children and others to our animals, whether it be emotional capital as well as financial capital. And to what extent do we kind of get things out of perspective with respect to animals compared to the needs of human beings, which are great throughout the world?
Yeah, this is an excellent point. Eileen?
I mean, that's kind of a war in New York City. There's so many playgrounds when Rosie was a puppy in my neighborhood in the East Village where I would take her out at night and throw the ball around and so on. And all those playgrounds have shut down since then because there's a competition between people with kids and people with dogs, even though they're sometimes the same people. And an idea that dogs mess up spaces for children. And so child spaces should be dog free. And you know, I think in a situation where space is at a premium, we get very competitive about it. And I do mourn that, of course, because I, you know, as someone who never decided to have a kid, my dog is not my child, but is certainly as important in my life as a child might be in somebody else's.
I always find it interesting when people have to. I don't have children either. And so I find myself making the same kind of qualification that you just did. And I don't know why we feel like we have to.
What do you mean?
When you said, I never had children, my dog is much. Well, we always feel like when we say my dog is my child, I feel like we have to also then go on to explain. Well, not like a real, you know, I think it's okay to say I think of my dog as my child, as that close of a companion to me.
Uh-huh.
And just be okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, truly, I think probably the language I think most clearly about my animals is they're my family.
Right.
They are absolutely family, you know, rather than making it generational, which leads me to another place about language, which is that every family has private language, private jokes, private fantasies about who this person really is. And I think that whole realm of life with an animal is really special. I think in my book, I looked at Rosie and I was like, this is my father. I felt like she had, you know, she was another personality coming through. And there's lots of magic in the relationship with the animal.
Yeah. I mean, you say, I think, that you felt seen by Rosie in a way that you were seen by family members, perhaps your father. What do you think it means to be truly seen by a companion animal?
I think it's, I mean, I think it is a certain kind of philosophical gaze, you know, which not all dogs have. I mean, honestly, with the animal, with dogs, I feel like it's very easy to say there are human dogs and there are animal dogs.
I love that. That's perfect, Eileen.
My current dog, Honey, is such an animal. I look in her eyes and I just see wildness. I see nature. I see a dog that would run and run and run. And when given the opportunity, she does do that, you know? And Rosie wanted to be with me, and she saw me, and she would walk down the street in New York, and people would just point her and go, look at that dog. And they felt she saw them. And it may be the size of her eyes, who knows, but there was a different vibe. And Honey's not got that vibe. She's somebody else.
That's perfect. I mean, that's when I think about, as I said, we've had a number of dogs, but when I think selfishly, best dog ever, Dara. Mm-hmm. That's it. What you've just said, that is it, the difference between animal and human.
Mm-hmm.
Call here from BJ in Eagan. Hi, BJ. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. I currently have a wonderful dog that is 13 years old. She's a Border Collie Bichon, which is, I call her a Bichali.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been going through changes this year in that she developed diabetes. And as a result of diabetes, went blind. So you start the fight with one problem, and then it goes to another problem, and yet you've made the commitment to make the fight, so you keep going. And in the midst of that, we're dealing with my father-in-law having stage 4 colon cancer. So ultimately, some decisions are based on what's right for the dog, and other times it's what's right for your family, because I don't want my husband to deal with the loss of our dog and his father at the same time.
Oh,
so, and when you talk about the loss of sight and what the eyes mean to both you and your animal, it was frightening to have her lose her sight. And yet I was blessed to be able to go to a canine ophthalmologist who was able to do cataract surgery and give her sight back to her. And the day after the surgery, I looked down and realized she was looking at me and I was looking to her. And the communication you do have and the love that you have is just amazing.
BJ, thank you. Thanks for the call. On Twitter here, Eileen, Shannon says, I got my dog Frodo after I got home from Iraq 10 years ago, Afghanistan 5 years ago. As he ages, I heal more from my wars. He taught me to love. Wow. Yeah, I bet you're hearing a lot of incredibly compassionate, meaningful stories as you go out to talk about this book.
It's absolutely what's happening. I didn't anticipate it. And I think when I first went to a librarian conference last summer and people were lined up and getting the book, and suddenly they were like, can I show you my dog? Can I show you my dog? Can I show you my – and now – and signing books to people and dogs. And you know, my dad had a dog that he loved and the dog died. Will you sign it to, you know, Fred and Ozzy? And it's just – it's kind of incredible. It's like it's giggly and then it's totally warm. Because, again, it's just like they are these – I mean, it's I think it's no accident that you lose an animal and you lose a family member in the approximate same time, because death is always with us. But the animal is so close that the intimacy that you have somehow just makes you stronger. It's kind of like going to the gym in order to do that special thing one day.
It's,
you know,
true.
It's like you're building emotional muscles.
Your writing changed, didn't it, with Rosie?
Well, that's what she says. she claimed that she gave me my writing at a certain point in time. But she absolutely – my poetry changed because, A, she brought me to different places. There were just kind of walks on the beach that I took with her that I probably wouldn't have taken. I mean, I know it's a nice thing to walk on the beach, and if I'm in a beach town, there it is. But do I do it? And do I do it in the morning? And do I do it late at night when the lights – you know, from the town or falling into the water. And, you know, so there was just this stunning aesthetic payoff for having a dog that was just about her doing her business and then giving me the world.
So are those changes now that you have Honey and Rosie has been gone from your life for a while, are those changes permanent, indelible?
Well, yeah, because I think it's a, for me, it's sort of like a, being a little too single to be dogless, you know. I mean, and it, what's strange, too, is that the dogs still come. I'm not very purposeful. And so, like, I found Rosie because I was walking down the street in the East Village, and it was daylight savings, and I hadn't really known what time it was. So I had an accidental free hour, and I came upon a dog who a dog with a litter around her, and quickly discovered that these people were selling this dog. And likewise with Honey, it was like I was doing alternate parking in New York, and I started talking to a former dog walker, and she discovered I was dogless. She hooked me up with a rescue person. I was going to foster a dog for a weekend, but suddenly I was rescuing Honey out of the city shelter, and she was going to be put down at 1 o'clock. So my dog choices have been very accidental, and then you can only decide that this is the right dog because it came through this magical door.
Eileen, did you know that before or after you adopted Honey?
Say that again. Did I know?
Did you know that Honey was going to be put down at 1 o'clock before you learned that after?
No, that's why I took her. Because I was gonna foster a little, as described, a little submissive pit bull named Mandy. And somebody else was going to take her on Monday. And I thought, okay, I can take a dog for a week. And that would be just, that's about the size of the dog life I could do right now. And then suddenly the same person sent me an email, and it was this crazy looking dog with glittery eyes and a bow behind her head. She was all, you know, gussied up for, you know, for adoption. And they were like, this one goes down at 1 o'clock. And it was like 1:06. It was already, she should have been dead already. And I was like, ah, and I remember my fingers flying on my computer, like, I must have Honey. I must have, you know, and so, and she was, and she's not, you know, she's better now. She was not an easy dog, you know. So at first I was like, what have I done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you bring a new dog into your life, you have grown, you know, the grooves are worn in with the last animal. And you bring a new animal in and you think, it's not going to be like that. Can I live with it? You know, I always have that moment of panic, like, is this going to fit? Is this going to work? Sounds like you did too.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the problem with experience. Just the fact that you have it means you think that you know something. You know, I know how to write a book. I know how to be on a radio show. I know how to have a dog. I know how to have a relationship. You always think, here I am with all my experience. I should not. And boom, it's a different shaped dog. It's a different shaped life. It's a different story. And you have to, like, suddenly figure out how to be present with this one.
All right. Adam says on Twitter, my dog died sleeping, had started to show signs of aging. I was thankful to not go through the death process. What's that say? Well, Adam, I think that's natural. I think a lot of us wish we could avoid it. That's part of loving dogs. That's what I tell myself when I start to see my dog age. To Matt in Rochester. Hi, Matt. You've been through this, it sounds like.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I learned some important life lessons from my dog. Her kidneys and liver were failing. Pardon me. We took her to the vet, and the vet said, well, we can keep her alive for a period of time in this way. And as we struggled with decisions after we were told that, I realized that I needed to love her enough to let her go, and not to make her life a series of suffering events that she was not going to understand and that were only going to prolong her life for my benefit. And the real important lesson I learned from that, and I'm not equating the two decisions, but a couple of years later, I was power of attorney for my brother, who reached a similar point in his life. And I had difficult decisions to make, but realizing that I needed to love him enough to let him go when he was ready to go and wished to go was an important lesson that my little puppy a couple of years earlier had taught me.
I can see that, Matt. I mean, there had been an experience of practice there, right?
Yeah.
For that.
Difficult decisions.
Eileen, do you... As you've talked to people about the experience with Rosie and about the memoir, I mean, do you hear people say, so this taught me more about how to lose a family member or how to be when a family member is dying? Maybe you didn't expect that.
No, yeah, absolutely not. But I think it's, you intuit it in a way. I think the fear of letting go is that we don't know what's next. We don't know what the void is like. We don't know what the absence is like. We don't know what dogless feels like. You know, I don't know how to be in my house without, you know, four legs trotting around after me, you know, and I think it's the fear of that void that keeps us hanging on and trying to, you know, give some crazy drug to the dog or
for sure.
Whatever. I mean, with all our decisions, of course. I mean, that's the thing, too. It's sort of like the teaching is how to make a decision and not be overwhelmed with the aftermath, which you don't know. You can't know.
You know, when we when our dog Honey died, we had a Honey too, and we felt like, and I look back and I think, why? But we felt like, okay, we need to spend at least 3 months cherishing the experience with Honey and not going out and adopting a new dog. I felt like I thought I was going to need that time to mourn, and what I couldn't stand it within about 30 days. We were at the Humane Society to adopt.
Right.
How did you think about that? The time without Rosie. Yeah.
I thought, well, I had a cat. I mean, it was just like I got a cat while I had her, which seemed at first impossible. It seemed like she was going to kill the cat. But then they became great friends. So I think the cat and I were kind of like these two guys kind of mourning our loss together. And I actually waited a long time. I think it wasn't until I got involved with somebody and they wanted a dog that I was convinced. And maybe I was rushed a little bit, you know, and then had a couple of dogs for a number of years. But Honey was more like, and so in many ways was like the next dog. And that was a few years. That might have been a decade. But I was writing about Rosie in that decade. So I guess that's probably
right.
The point.
She was with you. Yeah, in that decade. The next time you're in the Twin Cities, I really hope you'll come into the studio and we'll just talk about whatever, okay? It'd be great to have you here.
Deal.
Thank you.
Deal.
Good.
Yeah.
Eileen Miles' memoir is called Afterglow, A Dog Memoir, and you can read about it on The Thread.